This is Kevin Baldwin.
This is Eric Vernon.
And we are Baldwin and Vernon. And today we're going to talk a little bit about how Eric and I came to be lawyers and partners together. So Eric, let's start with you. Where are you from?
So, you know what? My early days were spent in Dallas, Texas. And then we moved to Kansas City when I was 8 or 9 years old, way long time ago in the 70s.
So he's still a Texan, though.
That's right. But you know what I tell people? I stopped being a Dallas Cowboys fan when they fired Tom Landry.
That was a long time ago. I bet we have people watching this podcast who don't even know who Tom Landry is. Right.
But I spent most of my growing up going to junior high and high school over in Prairie Village, Kansas. Went to Shawnee Mission East.
What did you do after high school?
After high school, well, I went to the United States Coast Guard Academy. I got a full tuition room and board scholarship in exchange for 5 years of service. So I went to New London, Connecticut, and spent 4 years at Coast Guard Academy.
Is it just like we see in the movies where it's drills and classes, everybody in uniform?
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of a blend of, oh, and here's some old references, the movie Taps and the movie Officer and a Gentleman.
All mixed into one.
In fact, the Officer and a Gentleman, and again, this is an old reference now, but an officer and a Gentleman, that movie came out the summer that I reported to the Coast Guard Academy. So I was going through what we called Swab Summer as Mayo was going through OCS.
OCS is Officer Candidate School. So you were there for 4 years, and you graduate, and when you graduate, what rank were you given?
So I was commissioned as an ensign, and you know, I reported to the Coast Guard Cutter Woodrush in Sitka, Alaska, and I spent 2 years as a junior officer. And as a junior officer, you're mid-level management. It's kind of like, and it's interesting because of the cases we do, the employment cases, because I was the young kid, the 22-year-old kid who's brought in to be in charge of, you know, the food service operation and the communications operation. And eventually I was the operations officer. And I was working with a bunch of first-class petty officers and chiefs who had been working, doing their job and their specialty for 20, 25 years. And it was my job to supervise these guys.
Now, you supervise those guys, but you also have to supervise the younger miscreants, like 18, 19, 20-year-olds.
Oh, yeah. Right. And that was its own difficulty, right? That was its own magic because, oh, for heaven's sakes, they changed the drinking age in the 80s. So even in Alaska, you had to be 21 to drink. And we had a bunch of 18, 19-year-olds on the ship. And the Coast Guard started getting really serious about it. Anyway, dealing with young men with alcohol problems, and you know, and I have a lot of clients who say, I don't have an alcohol problem, and I have to respond, you know, you're facing felony charges for your third DWI. You may not be an alcoholic, but you have an alcohol problem. And that was the kind of thing I dealt with. I had these young men, and you know, they weren't any different than I was 4 years earlier when I was 19-year-old in Connecticut. But when I was a 19-year-old in Connecticut, the drinking age was 19.
And during your time in the Coast Guard, you had a lot of superior officers you had to report to.
Oh, yeah.
Were some good?
Yes. Yes.
Notice how long you took? Yes.
Well, you know, you remember the outstanding ones, and the outstanding ones were the screamers, right?
Okay. The get-stuff-done kind of guys.
Well, the guys who thought they got stuff done by screaming, yeah.
Were they the good guys or the bad guys?
Those were the bad ones.
Those were the bad. So the screamers were the bad guys.
But you know what? Like lawyers and judges that we deal with, yeah, over the years, you know, there were the leaders that I learned from and thought, okay, that's who I want to be like. And then there were the ones that you think, boy, if I ever see you again.
Now, we've had cases come in where we've actually got to look through people's employment files. And looking through there, oftentimes, would you agree that we don't have, or our clients aren't perfect people?
Hey, nobody's perfect. Nobody's perfect. And including the supervisors, it's funny you say that because we had, you know, we, the military, we had those evaluations way back in the 70s and 80s. We had those evaluations where there's seven bubbles, and one means you should find another line of business, and seven means, you know, you should be deep selected for Admiral. And then there were all kinds of descriptions, detailed descriptions. And so one of my jobs later on, I was an executive officer. I was in charge of the whole ship of 60 men, and the seven or eight supervisors, the junior officers and the chiefs who evaluated everybody else. And so I would evaluate the evaluators. And it's interesting to look and see all the different ways people evaluate. I mean, some people are just straight threes and you got to be really good to get a four. Some people are straight sixes and you got to get really bad to get a five. And then we had to work with them to say, hey, you know, you guys aren't that different, and try to have them redo their evaluations. But anyway, we see these evaluations of our clients all the time.
I noticed that in your depositions, I've reviewed your depositions, you've reviewed mine. I noticed that actually when you start delving into that with managers and depositions who have done something to our clients or might be witnesses in our cases, I noticed that you're really able to pick those evaluations apart. Do you think that's because of your experience?
Yeah. And in fact, I will tell you that one of the most shocking things, I don't know why I'm still shocked by it, but in our practice, we depose, we evaluate, we sue employers and supervisors often who have no training in HR, right? No training in organizational behavior. They've never been to college, or they've been to college, but they went to college to learn communication skills or whatever, and they didn't learn anything about how to evaluate people, or about how to lead people, or about how, you know, position power versus personal power, and how to get people engaged and stuff. And it just amazes me at how little training they have. And then it does not at all surprise me that they then end up getting sued because they don't know the law, they're violating the law, and they're not doing the things that they would have learned in some educational program that could have prevented this.
Well, the thing that I think always kind of shocked me was when you see that and you think to yourself, well, the employer should recognize this. This is the third or fourth time the employer's been sued for this. They should recognize this. But we've kind of figured out that they don't seem to recognize it.
No, they don't.
And
no,
a lot of times what they'll do is they'll let that go forward. Now, but after your time in the Coast Guard Academy, what did you do then?
So I served two tours on buoy tenders in Alaska, and in between I spent 4 years at an admiral's staff basically in St. Louis. And while I was there, I was a single officer in a big city, and so I was bored, so I went to law school at night.
Most people just drink or join a basketball team, but
St. Louis University had a law school at night law school back then, and so I'm a night law school hack.
That's fantastic. But you're dedicated, because in addition to working full-time as a commissioned officer in the armed services, you were actually pursuing a law degree at the same time.
That's right. And although it is not my want to brag, since we're talking about it, during those years I was at the Admiral staff and going to school at night, I was not able to accelerate. Like, you can accelerate your night school by going during the summer. But for whatever reason, two summers in a row, the Coast Guard sent me to fill in somewhere else. So the first summer of law school, I was sent to the Caribbean, where I spent a month and a half on a nuclear-powered cruiser. And we were fighting the drug war. There was a Coast Guard Coast Guard Commodore who was in charge of a squadron of Navy and Coast Guard assets. And so I worked down there on his staff for a month and a half. And then the next summer, I ended up in the Persian Gulf for our first adventure in the Persian Gulf.
For the first Persian Gulf War.
That's right.
And in fact, you weren't alone there. Your brother actually served there as well.
That's right. Well, and so I didn't end up there until after the shooting stopped. I volunteered way early on and didn't get selected. Meanwhile, my brother, who's a West Point graduate, his tank platoon was one of the first American tanks in Saudi Arabia on the border with Iraq, right? In whatever that was, August of 1990, right? 1990 or 91?
I think so, 1991.
Yeah.
So so after you've been on the Admiral staff, you're pursuing your law degree, what did you do after you left the service?
Well, I came back to St. Louis and finished law school full-time. that last year. And then I worked for a small firm, kind of like ours, in Alton, Illinois for a while. And I was laid off.
Which happens sometimes in law firms, yes.
And at that point, I decided, for whatever reason, I was young and still thought I still have opportunity to do something else. So I went and got my master's mariner's license, and I spent the next 3 years working on tugboats offshore.
Now, when you were doing that, here's a very important thing. You were actually a member of a union, weren't you?
I was a member of the Seafarers International. In fact, that's how I got the job. I mean, I was looking for jobs. I went to apply for a job at a non-union offshore supply boat company, one of the largest in the world. And during the interview session, they were bragging to me. The guys that were going to hire me were bragging to me about how they fire anybody that talks about organize. And I actually said, because I don't know, because I'm a lawyer and I'm naive, I said, you can't do that.
Did you get the job?
I did not get the job. But then I joined the union and I got a much better job. And in fact, one of the funniest things I've ever seen, two funny things, two union stories. One, I'm sitting in a bar in Hitchcock, Texas, which is down in between Houston and Galveston, and most of the economy down there is the refineries. So I'm sitting there nursing a beer, talking to some fella I just met, and he's going on and on, complaining about the refinery he works at, and complaining about the bosses, and complaining about the hours, and complaining about the poor pay. And I said, do you ever think about organizing? And he said, I'm not gonna let some East Coast union come down here and tell me how to live my life. So I guess the answer was no. And then like 3 months later, we're offshore and we shared a job with a non-union boat. We towed an oil rig out to the oil field, and there was rough weather, and so we spent a couple of days just kind of laying to. And there was a day when we were sitting tied up next to this non-union boat, and they asked us how much we made, or maybe we said, why don't you guys join the union? I don't remember. Anyway, they told them how much we made, or they told us how much they made, and it was half what we made. And we told them that, and they didn't believe us. And one of the guys ran down and got his check stub and came out and showed him. Oh, God. Not only do I make twice what you do, but look at all the vacation days I'm earning. And they swore up and down that the union gave us those documents, those false documents, just to confuse them.
So even back then, people weren't willing to look at facts if they conflicted with their beliefs.
That's right. Well, and back then, I mean, you know, it's hard to convince Upton Sinclair said, it's hard to convince a man to believe something
that's in opposition to his wage.
Right, it's opposition, yeah. Yeah.
True. I can see that. So after you were sailing for a while, what made you decide to come back and be a lawyer?
Well, I fell in love. And I fell in love with a gal here in Kansas City, and she didn't like the idea of me being gone 2 or 3 months at a time and not ever being really sure when I was coming back. So we dusted off that old bar license and shipped around for work. And I don't know if you can tell on the podcast, but I grew my hair long while I was working offshore, and I didn't really want to cut it off yet. So I thought, well, let's look for work. Well, it was not easy to find a job as a lawyer. Funny thing, a lot of people, my clients don't mind, the judges don't mind, but the big firms downtown weren't too keen on that, so I ended up getting a job as a Missouri public defender, and that's where we met.
That's where we met.
The rest is history.
The rest is history, then.
As I say.
Kind of a funny thing is he was assigned as the public defender to the courtroom where I was assigned as the prosecutor, and we actually used to be in opposition to each other on cases, and we tried cases against each other. And I remember when I left the prosecutor's office, I remember thinking to myself, well, there needs to be another guy in the firm I'm in who does criminal, but I need someone who's smart, who knows what they're doing, and more importantly, is ethical, meaning that when judges or prosecutors, when he walks into the room and he says, no, I got something to really talk to you about, they would actually believe what he said. He had the credibility factor. I looked around all the all my options of joining up with somebody, and it was Eric Vernon. He was top of the list, and that was a long time. That was back
like 2003,
in 2003. Since 2003, so that was 16 years ago, and we've been together ever since.
Yep. So Kevin,
yes,
where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in Iowa. I graduated with 37 people in my graduating class. So everybody knows everybody in the small town, interesting enough. And I was able, well, while I was there, though, I did what small town kids do. I worked in the fields, worked in the farms, made money walking beans, detasseling, working in the fields, working on some farms. And then when I was 14 and got my work permit, I went to work at a poultry farm. As I think I've said before, it's, you know, it's a place with chickens and stuff.
Right. Let's back up, though. Did you ever spend any time in a library?
Yes. In a small town in Iowa, when you grow up in a small town without air conditioning, and it's hot in Iowa in the summer, at that time I decided that the best place to be would be at the public library because it was air conditioned. And the nice thing was the town librarian there really welcomed me in and gave me a lot of books to read. And so I was spending my summers, I would play in the morning, going out with my friends when I was younger. And then, because back then, you know, you were 7 years old, your parents would go to work and leave you home alone when you're seven, back in Iowa, back in the 70s. And so I would be in charge of getting my own lunch and everything like that. And then I would go spend the afternoons in the library reading. And so I read a lot. And I read everything. And the incredible thing is that it really opens up the world to you. And nowadays, kids have that with the internet. They can get a lot of information. A lot of them just seem to game. But I was reading a lot of different books, kind of expanded my education, my horizon. And I will honestly say, I think it made me a smarter kid. No doubt about that.
Now, was that the time when you started thinking about becoming a lawyer?
Actually, I was already programmed to that from my grandmother. My grandma was a very big fan of Perry Mason. And so when I was living with her when I was little, and it used to really make me upset because I wanted to watch Gilligan's Island. But if grandma came in, we're going to watch a rerun of Perry Mason. But she always told me how important it was to be a lawyer. And she always told me how important it was for people to have somebody like that to fight for them. And she always used to tell me when I was little that someday you're going to be a lawyer. And so it just seemed like the thing I was always going to do. So from the time I was young until now, I've always just wanted to be a lawyer. And I will tell you this, I'm one of the few people you're ever going to meet who's actually doing the very thing they always dreamed of doing.
That's right. So when you're talking to juries about Perry Mason moments, this is something that comes from the heart for you.
It does come from the heart for me, because one thing I noticed about, you know, Perry Mason always won his case. Now, actually, there was one show where Perry did not win his case. Now, he went on the back end with an appeal after acquired evidence came out. But, so there's only one. But in all those, the thing that actually came up, and if you actually watch those shows, I still watch them on MeTV, love it. One of the things that always comes up is you look beyond face value. And that's really what that show teaches you, is you don't take what the government tells you at face value. You go deeper. There's an easy answer, but what's beyond that? What makes this thing happen? Who else is involved? And why are they saying the things that they're saying? And I think that's one of the things that kind of instilled with me is, all right, there's a deeper thing here. But I never wanted to work for, I went to the University of Iowa, and then I worked in all kinds of jobs. I worked in factories, production factories, factory floors, agricultural plants. And then I did office work, and then I worked in sales, sold cars and things like that.
Well, and in fact, so I was going to go back, and you filled in all those jobs you had along the way. You actually specifically decided to go into sales, right?
I did.
Why was that?
I had graduated undergraduate, and I was working doing credit investigations for a mortgage company. We're looking at the business information from large corporations, whether or not we extend them credit. And I happened to go to a political event, and I met a very well-known lawyer in Iowa, a guy who had done a lot of big cases, a lot of products liability cases. And so I went to talk to him, and I said, hey, I want to be a lawyer too. I'm taking some time off to make some money and trying to get some experience. And he was very gracious. He said, well, what kind of what are you doing? I said, I'm working for a bank. He's like, oh, you want to be a banking lawyer? I said, no. I want to be do what you do, products liability or civil rights law is what I'd really like to do. And then he said, well, then why are you working at a bank? I said, to get experience. He said, okay, well, do you know how to negotiate? And I said, yeah, I can negotiate. No, I could not negotiate. And he pointed that out to me. I knew nothing about it. But then he asked me if I knew how to sell anything. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said that if I wanted to be a good trial lawyer, because I told him that's what I wanted to be as a trial lawyer, I needed to learn how to sell things. I needed to learn how to talk to people. I needed to learn how to take negative information, process it, and be able to address it. And he told me that if I went and I sold something, sold cars, for instance, that I would be able to do that, better able to communicate to juries, better able to convey to them important things, and better at public speaking. And so I sat there with a dumb look on my face and said, so you're telling me to go sell cars? And he said to me, in the not very nice way, I'll tell you, he said, look, when a guy who made several $1 million last year has given you free advice on how to be successful in this very same line of work, take the advice or don't. Either way, I'm done talking to you. And he turned on his heel and walked away. I remember thinking to myself, sales it is. That's what I'm going to do. A couple weeks later, I'm working at a dealership in sales, and they did teach me a lot about sales, about how to talk to people, how to talk to different people. I sold cars to doctors, to lawyers, and engineers. At the same time, I sold them to farmers and farm laborers. And you have to be able to reach people and to tell them about the things you want to tell them about, to tell them about the things that are important, and to answer their questions and do it in the right way. And so I did learn sales. And I went back to law school. Funny thing is, when I was leaving for law school, the people at the dealership I worked, they were asking me, are you sure you want to do this, Kevin? You're really good in sales. I was, but my dream was to be a lawyer. So I went to law school. When I was in law school, I actually had the opportunity to try a couple cases as a law student, which was very exciting. I moved to Kansas City. I got hired into a firm that did employment law. I stayed there for the first 2 years learning that, but realized I needed to get a lot more trial experience because I wanted to try cases. And that's why I went to the Clay County Prosecutor's Office. And there, one thing about a small county prosecutor's office, if you want to try cases, they will give you the opportunity.
One other thing, let's go back. Where'd you go to law? Or we talked about law school. Where did you go to law school?
I went to a place called Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Lansing, Michigan. It's one of the few places that would actually give me a scholarship to go, so I wanted to go. And now it's called Western Michigan University.
And where'd you go to undergrad?
University of Iowa. So I'm an Iowa boy.
What was your major in?
I actually double majored, a couple of different majors. I had majors in political science and communication theory, and they actually have one of the best communication schools up there. A lot of it is small group communication, like juries, and because those are well-funded, and so they get a lot of experience. So I was in the programs up there and learned a lot about communication, nonverbal communication, political science, but then I also minored in history and drama. And the drama, of course, because I'd always planned on being in front of a jury. And what the one thing I want to do is I want to be able to communicate with a jury. I want to be able to tell them the story about what happened. I want to be able to represent my client and tell the story.
So in addition to being one of the few people I know who loves your job as much as you do, you're also one of the few people I know that prepared as carefully throughout the years for the
I
job.
Did.
And it's paid off.
I did. I did all the way from back from middle school. I started reading everything I could about the law, legal cases, things like that. And then I was in speech. Then I was in dramatics in high school, school plays, things like that. Anything I could do that I thought would help me someday be a better trial lawyer. I always wanted to be a trial lawyer. And then I got the opportunity.
And then, do you remember, did you keep track? Were you one of those guys keep track how many trials you tried as a prosecutor and your win-loss record?
I just know it was a lot. Because I got called up a lot to help pick juries or to be second chair on stuff. And I won a lot of cases. And then in the private practice, we've won a lot of cases as well.
But a lot. We're talking like high double digits, right?
We're talking about double digits. We are. And one of the nice things about that is it's a lot of experience. Now, here's the thing about being a prosecutor. You're geared to win. More often than not, you get the breaks your way. People just automatically assume that you're in the right because you're a prosecutor. We talked earlier about people wrongfully convicted because people will go, well, prosecutor wouldn't bring this unless they knew. So it's a little bit of a rigged deck a little bit. I'll just say along those way, luck favors you in those situations. But when we moved to the civil cases, it became a little bit different because, unfortunately, a lot of America has been geared to dislike plaintiffs. For some reason, it's strangely enough, like I said, most of the people I represent are Republicans, and they always tell me the same thing. I'm not the kind of person that sues. I'm not one of those people. Well, most of our clients are.
In fact, I would say stay tuned, right? Same bat time, same bat channel here in 3 or 4 months, and we'll be talking about McDonald's coffee cups and punitive damages.
Absolutely. But after getting some time in the prosecutor's office, I knew I wanted to go back and do civil rights work. I wanted to do employment discrimination. And so that is what I wanted to do. I still do a little criminal. I help Eric on criminal cases, but predominantly I do employment discrimination. That's civil rights, whistleblower work, and that's really what I do. And I love what I do.
All right. Well, thank you very much for telling us about yourself and for doing all that prep work.
No problem. This is Kevin Baldwin
and Eric Vernon.
And we're Baldwin and Vernon.